Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationship with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away this week. She'll be back next week. Jonathan Waterman is a writer, photographer, and the author, most recently, of National Geographic's Atlas of the National Parks. Two Sundays ago, an op-ed he wrote was printed in the New York Times, and its title was, "Our National Parks Are in Trouble." In it, he describes how overcrowding, invasive species, climate change, and budget cuts are combining to overwhelm and threaten the health and welfare of our national parks. Joining us by phone to discuss this piece is Jonathan Waterman. Jonathan, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me this morning on This Green Earth.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I thought we'd start here with a little bit of background about yourself, because you were once a park ranger, correct?
Yeah, I worked at two different national parks, in Rocky in Colorado and Alaska's Denali National Park.
And when was that?
Back in the early 1980s.
Oh, back then. Okay. So, okay, that's a good setting then. So back when you were working in those parks back then, what was, would you say, the national park system like or different than it is today?
Well, I think that we haven't at that point experienced the sort of overcrowding that we're seeing now. There's of course, over 330 million people a year are visiting all of the national parks. That's greater than the entire population of the U.S. And 30 years ago, the parks weren't seeing those kinds of numbers. So there's just been a general sort of attrition by wear. But also, in that time, in the last three decades, we've also experienced radical changes in climate, which have resulted in drought in some places, extreme temperatures, and notably invasive species.
Right. Right. Okay, so fast forward now, and let's take each one of those separately, starting with overcrowding. I mean, that sounds, in some ways, that's good news in a sense that people really love our national parks. And it's not just those of us who live in the U.S. that visit national parks. Our U.S. national parks are an international draw. People from around the world want to visit our parks. And so more and more of them are visiting these parks every year.
Very true. And to a certain extent, these parks are designed for crowds of people. The roads have been carefully engineered. And a lot of the impact actually occurs on the roadways and initially on some of the trails. For instance, Yosemite Valley, one of the 10 most crowded national parks, sees more than 95% of its traffic just in the central Yosemite Valley, and there's so much more to that park than that roadway and the valley that most tourists go to. So many parks can actually accommodate this kind of load, but others can't, such as Zion National Park, mm-hmm. which has more people per acre than any of the other national parks, and there it's a desert environment versus Yosemite, and that desert environment it just can't withstand the kind of numbers that are not only on the roadways and clogging up the roadways via the shuttle bus system, but on the trails and walking up notably the streams or more popular trails like Angel's Landing.
Right.
So there are not only just sort of the aesthetic impacts in these crowds, but there are very real ecological impacts to the wildlife in that park and others like it that it just can't be designed for those kinds of numbers, those millions and millions every season.
Right. I remember my brief experience visiting Zion. This is some 25 years ago, before the shuttle system, I think, was in place. I drove in, I couldn't find a parking spot, I drove out. And then I had to find, eventually found another way in design. But that was just a late September afternoon. It wasn't even peak season. And that park is, you know, in effect being loved to death. But that was my experience at Scion.
Right, and it's an example of a marketing problem just gone haywire. In fact, a marketing program of the state of Utah that's proved so successful that it's gone overboard because, like other parks such as Arches National Park or Grand Canyon, people simply can't get into the parks. And I'd like to talk about solutions, at least in brief here. You know, these parks could see it to actually perform some science to determine the carrying capacity, i.e., the human carrying capacity, in order that each park has a sort of a tolerance for the number of people, be it crowds or use on the trails. And if those tolerances were sort of applied to each park individually, you know, we might have to limit numbers in some of these parks, but it would then allow us to stand by the mandate of preserving these parks for eternity and for future generations.
Right. So do any parks apply that process right now?
Well, the parks that have tried, most notably in Yellowstone National Park, our most iconic, the world's most iconic national park, the superintendent tried to do just that, and pretty soon the superintendent found that he was out of a job, and the new superintendent doesn't breathe a word about limiting use.
Interesting. Okay, so that's could be a possible solution, but it's not one that this current administration necessarily embraces.
Bullseye.
Okay. So you could raise, I guess, some other options. You could raise fees, but that has an obvious inequity associated with it.
Right. I think, again, it's simple science. There are many other preserves or, for instance, state parks where this kind of science is performed, and visitors would accept that. People would be disappointed, but as a national policy, I think it would make a lot of sense. You know, we have to look at why we created these parks in the first place, not only for everyone to enjoy them, but to preserve them for future generations. And that is not being done right now.
Okay. So that's the overcrowding stressor. Let's spend a couple minutes on this idea of invasive species. That's a really fascinating one. You cite some numbers, for example, in Yellowstone. Yellowstone has 1,386 native plant species and 225 non-native ones. That's just plants, you know, because invasive species include plants, animals, insects, birds, etc. This is a growing
issue. I think it's important to understand the gravity of invasive species.
Right.
I can give you an example. You know, we're talking about Yellowstone now. One of those many invasive species happens to be cheatgrass.
Yeah.
And cheatgrass has taken over much of the western U.S. and its national parks. And I know this because I happen to have it in my own backyard here in Colorado. That's a grass that grows very quickly, takes over other native grasses, and then quickly dries out. So it is fuel for forest fires, and the sorts of forest fires that we're now seeing in places like Yellowstone, Yosemite, fast-moving, desperately hard-to-control fires. Well, there you have it. Species like cheatgrass are at the foundation of these fires. And that's only the beginning of a splurge of issues created in imbalance, creating an imbalance within the greater ecosystem.
Right, and there's also that knock-on effect, that ecological knock-on effect that occurs when a non-native species like cheatgrass might come in. It pushes out native grasses or other plants, which then can impact animals, birds, ground-based animals that might rely on those native grasses. So there's a whole ripple effect that goes on with the appearance of just one non-native species.
That's right.
So the other one is always the classic Everglades National Park, and there you have, I mean, that whole state is ripe with non-native species in all manner. But Everglades National Park is really not only suffering from non-native species, but now fewer people are visiting the park because it's losing its natural setting.
Yeah, Everglades, I would have to say, in my humble opinion, is the most endangered of all our 61 national parks. Mm. And, you know, underlying that, if I could point to one thing, it's water.
Yeah.
And it's water that's being denied to the park because the park was created by its fresh water from the north. But that water has been channeled off to metro areas mostly along the eastern seaboard. And now the water that does come in, perhaps a third of what used to be or less, is contaminated with agricultural contaminants and therefore damaging the rest of the Everglades.
Right.
But it doesn't stop there. From the south, because of increasing storm surges and rising ocean tides, basically seawater is broaching the southern boundaries of the Everglades and creating these mangrove areas that didn't used to exist, and saline water is working its way up into these unique freshwater marshes. And the Everglades were the first national park actually created not for their spectacular vistas or scenery, but for really this unique biodiversity. And that biodiversity is not only strained, but in many instances utterly destroyed. And that includes being destroyed from within and without by water, but also just an incredible evasion of non-native species found there now,
right,
today. But I hasten to add that these places are still places of great beauty and splendor. There's nothing like them in the world, and that's why tourists still continue coming to places like the Everglades, although in lessening numbers, sadly.
Right.
And they're not beyond saving. In fact, I intend to return to the Everglades again later this winter to explore a little bit more of these unique freshwater marshes, at least while they're still there.
Right. We're speaking with Jonathan Waterman, a writer, photographer, and the author, most recently, of National Geographic's Atlas of the National Parks. We're talking about an op-ed he wrote in the New York Times a couple Sundays ago titled "Our National Parks Are in Trouble." Got about five more minutes, Jonathan. You segued briefly to climate change and that's impacts in, you know, with respect to, say, the Everglades, salt water creeping in to freshwater zones, etc., surface, groundwater being impacted, and the knock-on effects of that. Where else are you seeing climate change kind of showing itself, expressing itself?
Most notably, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the loss of glaciers, particularly in the Glacier National Park of Montana, which has been arguably most impacted by loss of glacial ice. And there's a general consensus among scientific community that we will no longer see glaciers in Glacier National Park come, well, just 10 years from now, by 2030. There are just 25 glaciers left, and many of those glaciers have been reduced greatly. We've lost many other glaciers there. And this, of course, is because of rising temperatures. To a lesser extent, we see that in other northwestern national parks, in Olympic National Park, North Cades National Park, also in Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska, a seawater, sea level park. There's been a great loss of ice there as well. And to some extent, this is normal. Since the last ice age, the ice has been receding in Glacier Bay National Park, but the rate at which it has begun receding in the last few decades is has greatly accelerated the rate that it had been receding in the previous century.
Right, and here in Utah and in Colorado, climate change is expressing itself with respect to pine beetle, bark beetle, emerald ash borer coming in and decimating pine, forest, ash, trees, etc. As the world warms and they can survive through the winters. That's a whole other conversation.
Jonathan, I think that, you know, in this discussion, it's important not to be entirely apocalyptic about this, because we have an opportunity with our national parks to actually show how we can combat not only these issues of invasive species, but climate change itself. The national parks are, in fact, more susceptible to climate change than other lands across the U.S. according to a recent study from the University of California at Berkeley. And I think that if we use these lands, these park lands, as an exemplar of what we can roll up our sleeves and do, would bode well for the rest of the world.
Right. And I agree. And so let's talk about one final solution to address budget cuts and the deferred maintenance that's happening. Our current administration, in the introduction I read, says they plan to cut the budget of National Park Service by $480 million next year. Is there a movement this administration to suggest that maybe privatizing the operations of our national parks is what might be best for them?
Yes, there is, unfortunately, a movement to do just that. And the council came to that conclusion was made up of industry people representing, you know, large corporate campground interests and for instance, electric bicycles. And to some extent, privatization, to a small extent, perhaps privatization could be helpful, say, for campgrounds. But the idea of bringing wireless and Amazon deliveries into the national parks is just not the traditional use of these parks. It's not the sort of aesthetic that we've all valued in our parks for more than the last century. And I think that this administration doesn't understand that aesthetic. Parks are a place where we go to lose ourselves in nature, to study nature, and to bring the rest of the busy, maddening world into our parks. Would be a large mistake. It would be undoing all that we've created over the last century in these parks. So I think it would be a grave error to continue down that path. The proposal is utterly asinine. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm afraid most people that work for the parks don't get it either. It makes no sense at all.
Right. But it seems to be moving in that direction with budget cuts. And you talked about, even on the op-ed, about the morale in Washington with respect to the National Park Service, the number of staff that are being cut. It's a wholesale. I know we don't want to be too, like you say, use your word, apocalyptic about this. But there is a series of stressors that are occurring to our, being put upon our national parks. And actually, at the end of the day, Jonathan, maybe humans are the most invasive species when it comes to national parks.
I will buy that. I will completely buy that. But at the same time, we're the species that can undo a lot of the damage that are unfolding in front of our eyes.
I agree with that. And that's why we're chatting about this. And that's why I hope our listeners will turn to your op-ed in the Sunday New York Times Sunday paper, two Sundays ago. It was entitled, "Our National Parks Are in Trouble." Jonathan Waterman. Jonathan, do you have a website people can go to and learn more about your work?
Yeah, just that, jonathanwaterman.com. And I am also here to tell you that I have a new book out that tackles many of these thorny issues within the parks, as well as celebrating them. As you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Atlas of the National Parks. And I'm told it makes a great holiday gift.
That's why perfect timing is everything, Jonathan. And we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. And I think we'll stay in touch.